Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And it's not a nice day, but then that's my job, right? All the not a nice day events, reporting about all of those around the world. And as we begin the first working week of this brand new 2016, it looks like a crazy year. Why do I say that? Well, think about it. The presidential campaign is already without precedent. Outliers rule. Fear and uncertainty as the Obama era ends, even though in pure presidential terms, things are much more peaceful for the U.S. in 2016 than in 2008. But will that last? 2016 will be about rising interest rates. They're already going up, and China's growth continues to shrink. Confidence in China seems to be non-existent today. Markets are down the limit, rippling to Japan, Europe, and the U.S. More about all of that in a moment. And then there is a looming conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, framed as a confrontation between the Sunni Muslim and Shiite Muslim worlds.
This gruesome crime was only the enforcement of an order coming from America and Israeli intelligence services, dictated to their collared dogs in Saudi Arabia.
That's an Iranian cleric named Ahmad Panahanian reacting to the execution of a Shiite imam, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, by Saudi Arabia last week, part of a mass execution of 47 people declared mostly to be terrorists by the Saudi government. In response, angry Iranians attacked the Saudi embassy in Tehran, provoking Saudi Arabia to sever diplomatic ties. The United Arab Emirates has also downgraded its relations with Iran. So not a great beginning to this year. Could be worse, though, and we'll talk about all of that, how it could be worse, shortly with Ian Bremmer of the Eurasia Group and his latest risk assessment for 2016. But let's go to Iran now, where Thomas Erdbrink, as Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, is with us. Thomas, how seriously are the Iranians cracking down on the protesters?
Well, according to Iran's judiciary, over 50 protesters have been arrested and several Iranian officials have voiced their displeasure with what happened at the Saudi embassy. If these people will be held for a very long time, I do not know, because in Iran, nothing happens without the blessing of certain state factions. And I suspect, and many others with me, that some of these people that were out on that evening in front of the Saudi embassy were actually directed there by higher political powers, which I assume will also protect them from spending a long time in prison.
What about the official rhetoric towards Saudi Arabia? Is it targeted specifically at Riyadh? Has it changed? Or is it, as we heard from a protester on the street, is it thrown in with the old Saudi line of being lackeys of the U.S. government and Israel?
Look at the roots of the rhetoric. Saudi and Iran are the two biggest powers in the region when it comes to determining the future of Islam. Iran is a country that stands for a political Islam, as we have heard of since the Islamic Revolution 37 years ago, and the Saudis are more representatives of a more traditional Islam. And of course, they have both different denominations, because the Saudis are Sunnis, which are the majority in the Islamic world, and the Iranians are Shiites. Now, the rhetoric is, of course, based along those lines. Here in Iran, people think that the Saudis have ties to the United States, are planning on pushing Iran out of the region. And of course, the thought they have is that Saudi Arabia is strongly anti-Shiite. So they feel when a Shiite cleric is hanged in Saudi Arabia, as happened last week, they feel that actually it is them and their form of religion that is the target of this.
Conservatives in the United States have suggested that the Iranians are seizing on this execution as a way of taking advantage of accusing Saudi Arabia of being anti-Shiite, as you've said. And others have said that the Saudis, in fact, are taking advantage of this opportunity to try to raise its profile over ISIS as the Sunni leader in the region. How do you see it?
Well, I think the fact is that both countries have a certain ideology, and they're trying to sort of win the public heart and minds when it comes down to this role. The fact of the matter is that the Saudis have, on the 2nd of January, executed 47 people, including one of the most important opposition leaders in the country, who turns out also is a Shiite. And they very well knew that there would be a reaction from the Iranians, because the Iranians have been warning the Saudis for over the past year not to execute this man called Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. Now that this happened, it almost seems, at least that's what the Iranians say, as if the Saudis were seeking an excuse now to stop all diplomatic relations with Iran. Because, of course, they knew that certain Iranian hotheads would go out and throw firebombs at their embassy. And this action has actually helped the Saudis to cut the ties with the Iranians. It is just an increasingly complicated mess and complicated problem, but it doesn't make it less dangerous for this region.
Would there be any scenario whereby the Iranians and the Saudis confront each other militarily? We've seen the Saudis go into Yemen. There's certainly a new adventurism on the part of the Saudis. Do the Iranians fear that this could go beyond rhetoric?
Well, if you look at the region, you take a step back, you're seeing basically a whole string of proxy wars in Yemen, as you mentioned, but also in Syria, where they both support opposing groups. And of course, as was the fear in the Cold War, there's always a possibility of things getting out of control. Iran and Saudi face each other in the Persian Gulf. There are claims of certain Persian Gulf nations on islands that are currently held by the Iranians. These are all things that could spiral out of control in a future if increasingly bad decisions are being made on the part of both these countries. But we must also not forget, both these nations are looking towards the United States. Iran has just made a deal with the United States, an unprecedented and historic deal. And the Saudis, who were very opposed to this deal, now feel alienated from their former ally. So there is a feeling in the region that there's also lack of American leadership in this, and that this is allowing things to spiral out of control.
Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thomas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We go now to the markets, making the global economy nervous about the year 2016, and all of the anxiety is centered today on China. As I noted at the top of the hour, China's stock market dropped its limit of 7% today, causing a chain reaction in Asia, Europe, and North America. Jason Abruzzese is business reporter at Mashable. He joins us. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
So what does this mean, the markets are down the limit in China?
I mean, it basically means that China has suffered a small-scale stock market crash right now, and everybody's getting a little jittery about it.
And these are the first measures that China put in to stop a full-scale crash, and so far the test indicates that it worked or they failed. What do you think?
Well, I mean, they worked in the sense that, I mean, like any circuit breaker, you know, it's once they hit a certain limit, they trip and everything stops. And in this situation, it's if they hit a certain percentage of, the market as a whole declining, it basically just stops trading, tries to let everybody cool down. These are somewhat controversial measures still. We have them in the U.S. still as well. But oftentimes they are seen as possibly exacerbating the situation, because when they're meant to get everybody a time to, like, take a big deep breath and hopefully not get into this panic selling, it can also kind of, you know, cause the other thing, which is panic in the sense that people are holding on to these shares that they think are, you know, going to be declining even more and get very nervous and then want to sell even worse.
Is this about China's peculiar market, or is this the first opportunity investors had anywhere in the world to seize on the instability in Iran and Saudi Arabia, for instance, and some of the other instabilities that have now rippled into other markets?
Sure. I think Iran and Saudi Arabia certainly add to the situation going on in China, but there's no doubt that this is primarily led by what's going on in China and the fact that, you know, they just came out with some manufacturing data that, you know, really kind of, you know, came in below expectations, worse than people had hoped. And with the way China's market has been set up, as you kind of pointed out, it's a little peculiar. You know, there's been so much government intervention in the government buying up shares, kind of preventing people from selling, you know, big holdings of stocks. It's kind of propped the market up and made people very concerned, very wary that, you know, if anything, you know, could tip this market over, you know, it just takes one little nudge. And I think that's what we saw today, one piece of bad manufacturing data, and people were back to this kind of very panicked selling mode.
Forgetting about the world economy for just a moment, does this reduce or eliminate the secure sense of a wealth effect from the Chinese stock market for Chinese consumers in this new rising middle class? And will they express a certain amount of anger at the Chinese government for all of this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a serious concern amongst people in the Chinese middle class, especially people who have, you know, liquidated a lot of their assets. We've heard these, you know, kind of horror stories, and they're a little anecdotal, but of people kind of selling everything they own so they could buy more stocks, because the sense in China is, on some level, it's just going to keep going up. Partially because the Chinese government is going to make sure it either stays where it is or keeps going up, that it will not allow a crash. And that can make people a little wary, because that can only be maintained for so long. As far as, you know, backlash against the government, we've actually seen more backlash against businessmen in China than we have against the government. But if things get bad enough, there's no doubt that we'll have to see some of that, and it will be interesting to see what the government's reaction is, because as we've seen before, you know, the Chinese government tends to react very quickly to that kind of critique.
Are we going to see a year of this story, or is this a quick flash in the pan? And I guess what I'm getting at is, this doesn't speak well for the yuan joining the convertible currencies around the world all of a sudden.
Yeah, and we're starting to see already, you know, early this year that China is going to keep the yuan. They control that very, very tightly, how it trades against other currencies, and they're going to keep it weak is the indication that people are getting. So that's going to also be an issue going forward, but it's understandable based on where China is, why their central government would want to do that. I guarantee you no other government's very happy about it, because it is a form of kind of, you know, market manipulation. But as far as, you know, where we're going for the rest of the year, I think that this has to be one of your leading kind of, you know, market economy concerns going forward. Last year, maybe it was a little bit more the situation in Greece and Italy and things like that. But I think this year could, you know, end up being the year where you know, China's market, you know, is first and foremost, you know, in a lot of the business reporting you're going to see for 2016.
Jason Abruzzese is business reporter at Mashable. Jason, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks very much, John.
Well, with all those alarming stories, let's look at Mr. Care and Worry himself. He joins us in the studio, as he does every year. Ian Bremmer is the chairman and founder of the Eurasia Group. His risks report, latest risks report, is out today for 2016. Ian, welcome.
Would not miss it.
Yes, nice. Well, we do this every year. I'm wondering if any of those stories that we just heard, the markets in China, the Saudi Arabia-Iran business, even this radicalization out in Oregon, did any of that show up on your risk report?
Let's start with the good news. China didn't, and China shouldn't. Precisely because the market slowdown doesn't have a connection with the real Chinese economy. It's not an open market. You can't short it. And the Chinese government, as they've shown last year and they'll show this year, can intervene and will intervene politically massively to ensure that they don't have social instability on the back of all of this concern. But what we did write in this report, the China footprint is number three, and that is that the size of the Chinese market is so big and the impact of China has become so large that all of these perturbations that come, both negative and positive, have massive impact outside China. So it's not that Xi Jinping is under threat, but rather that we're going to see international markets rise and fall much more whipsawed this year by the surprises that come out of China, the negatives in terms of the markets, the positives in terms of the additional $1 trillion they'll spend outside of China in 2016.
The Saudi Arabia story comes in fifth,
yes,
I believe, in your assessment. Does it include this looming sectarian battle that seems to be framed in what's going on with China and or with Saudi Arabia and Iran right now?
Absolutely. And I mean, it's, you know, the first time that Saudi Arabia ever made it as a single risk in 16 years of putting these risks together in this report. Pretty much everything that could be going wrong for the Saudi kingdom is. They're running out of money. The oil prices are going to stay low. They are geopolitically, they've lost just about, know, sort of all of the allies they have in the region and more broadly. And the Iranians, their mortal enemy, are doing very well. We'll do even better on the back of this nuclear deal. Nuclear deal was the Republicans didn't like it. The Israelis certainly despised it. But it was a mortal threat to the Saudis. And the Saudis have now decided to take matters into their own hands. That conflict with Iran is very serious, perhaps mostly because the Saudis don't have a lot of international support.
Do you see the Saudis trying to upscale their profile over ISIS, that is trying to take sort of leadership in the Sunni kind of radical world right now, the jihadist world right now? You've got ISIS and friends at number four on your risks.
We do. And it's precisely that ISIS has become this threat well beyond the Islamic State, where some territory has been taken back by U.S.-led coalition and others.
The Ramadi success, I
guess. Yes, but there have been a lot of failures, and failures against ISIS as an organization around the region and in Europe has become a bigger threat, will become a bigger threat. And what these are very interlinked risks, right? Because it's very much the fact that the Saudis and the Iranians are going to be fighting each other tooth and nail means your ability to coordinate in responding to ISIS, your ability to coordinate in trying to create some kind of stability after 5 years of war in Syria is virtually zero. And that plays out to instability not just across the Middle East, but targeting right at the heart of Europe.
You begin with two very big ideas. Your top risk is called the Hollow Alliance, and your second risk is Closed Europe. They're related in the sense that there's no longer a grouping of nations that has the ability to drive world events in the way that we understood during the Cold War and in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War. And Europe, in your number two risk here, seems to be an isolated entity spinning off in its own world. What do you see that that means to the rest of the world?
Well, so if you look at the headlines today, Saudi Arabia and Iran, where is the United States in Europe? They're bystanders. They're on the sidelines. They're not coordinated and they don't think it's really their problem. And while I don't think that the U.S. elections are going to be a big issue for the U.S. markets and for investors and CEOs who think about, you know, the strength of the U.S. economy, my God, it matters for U.S. leadership internationally. The Americans are turning inward. They don't want to do this stuff anymore. The transatlantic relationship, which has been the most important alliance in the world for the last three quarters of a century, is nowhere on the agendas of anyone running for president on either the Democratic or the Republican side. Where when we look at the Europeans, we have them cutting their own relationships, whether it's the Brits with the Chinese because they desperately need some cash, or whether it's the French with the Russians because they want someone that's going to take a military role in the Middle East, in Syria in particular, or whether it's Germany and Turkey because they want someone to do something about the refugee issue. And all three of those countries, the three most important European allies of the United States, look across the Atlantic and they see the Americans lacking.
Americans weaker, Merkel weaker.
Weaker.
That's your definite takeaway there. Number eight and number 10, Brazil and Turkey. And people have been predicting the demise of Brazil for decades. Hasn't happened yet. What's your risk in Brazil? And how do you see Turkey being torn apart by what's going on in the conflicts you've already mentioned?
Brazil's not getting torn apart. It's not going to fall apart. But 2016 is going to be a very bad year, right? Because this we still have to work our way through the impeachment process of Dilma Rousseff, the president. We don't think she'll ultimately be impeached, but it's going to be nasty and fractious. And everyone around her and the former president, Lula, is going to be caught up in this extraordinary, unprecedented corruption scandal.
Oh, come on. It's the Olympics. There's a party in Rio. Come on. The whole world will come.
You know, I got to tell you, this is one I wouldn't show up for. Not because it's going to be so violent, but because they don't have the infrastructure, because the sites are far apart from each other. People are going to be sitting in traffic and not going to half of the places they have tickets for. If you're planning on Rio, this is not the year to get to Rio.
Right. Turkey and red herrings in your report, and then we'll go?
Well, Turkey is kind of – it's in the wrong place, and they've bet just about every geopolitically bad story they possibly could. Plus, they have a leader that doesn't back down ever, including on the Russians, which is now hitting them with sanctions. So it's going to be a bad year for Turkey. But the red herrings, right? A couple big stories here. Asian geopolitics, nowhere here. India-Pakistan looks better. China-Japan looks pretty stable. Even the South China Sea, you're going to have posturing, but these are countries that are focused on economics and focused long-term. So Asia, pretty separate from a lot of this geopolitical conflict. And the United States, as much as we talk about Trump, as what should we talk about, you know, a $10 billion two-year farce of a political campaign, the impact that actually has on the United States, virtually zero.
Dare we say a happy note there? Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
You can find the risks at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Will 2016 be about radicalization, foreign and domestic? Here's what some of the conservative pro-gun anti-government militia websites are saying about the curious confrontation taking place right now between the federal government and some ranchers in rural Oregon. This is the very definition of terrorism. It is not outside terrorists Americans must watch for. It is the contracted and employed terrorists by the general government. That statement is from TakePledge.com. What's happened is that over the weekend, a protest in Burns, Oregon, ended with an occupation of a small federal landmark in southeastern Oregon.
We stand in defense, and when the time is right, we will begin to defend the people of Harney County in using the land and the resources, and that is our intent.
That's a well-armed militiaman, Ammon Bundy, protest rancher from Nevada, who's occupied the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Harney County, Oregon, on behalf of the Hammond family of ranchers from Burns, Oregon.
This gathering isn't about me at all. It isn't about my ranch. It isn't about my family. It's about America has to get its feet back under it and go forward.
That's Dwight Hammond, who's been giving tearful statements about his treatment by the Federal Bureau of Land Management for days, if not weeks. Joining us now is Amelia Templeton, reporter and producer for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Amelia, how long has this dispute between the Hammonds and the BLM been going on?
Well, Dwight Hammond described it as a vendetta that really stretched back decades. I think there's been a long history of tensions between the family and the BLM over various land management practices. Like many ranching families out here, they have some of their own land, but they also lease land from the BLM to graze their cattle on. And that often creates conflict and tension over how the BLM is managing its land, how fires are managed out here, if the BLM is aggressive enough in fighting fires. So there's really a history of conflicts between these ranchers and the BLM that dates back 20 years at least, I'd say.
What are people in the local area saying about this militia group coming to Burns, Oregon with AR-15s and all kinds of weapons and staking out a confrontation with the federal government?
Well, I think a lot of people are actually trying to figure out what's going on, and they're in the process of forming an opinion about this. Many people here relate to the concerns that Ammon Bundy has raised about things like federal overreach or the inability of ranchers or loggers to access federal lands the way that they did in the 70s and the 80s. That said, I've heard from a lot of people, we don't think they're doing this the right way, or this isn't the way that you go about these things. And I've also heard concern that this isn't really about the Hammonds, that it appears to be a bit of a publicity stunt on the part of the militias, and that it's actually in some ways taken attention away from the Hammonds case and their situation.
What does it look like at the site? Is it less than meets the eye, more?
Well, it's a really remote place. The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is not a place very many people visit this time of year. It's somewhat popular in the spring for bird watchers, but we're talking about a pretty small group of buildings out in the middle of some very flat, beautiful country that's very snowy and very cold right now. And really there's ranches, but not much else for about 30 miles in any direction.
So this could stay a standoff for quite a while, and we will stay in touch with you, Amelia. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Amelia Templeton is a reporter and producer for Oregon Public Broadcasting, watching the standoff in Burns, Oregon, between militia groups and the federal government over a ranching dispute with the Bureau of Land Management. As Chinese markets tank today and the world tries to orient itself with the Chinese yuan joining the world's convertible currencies, we wonder how successful China will eventually be in bolstering confidence in its superheated but also volatile economy. We might look to the euro, which was adopted this week back in 1999 by 11 member states. Greece joined in 2001, and in 2002, the euro notes rolled off the presses. The happy story of the euro has become very murky in the last 2 years. 2015 was a particularly bad year with instability on many fronts, the Greek crisis, the migrant crisis. Martin Sandbu writes the free lunch column for the Financial Times. He's written a book on the long, strange journey of the euro. His book is called Europe's Orphan, The Future of the Euro and the Politics of Debt. For all of its problems, the euro has made itself essential to the world financial system. And by that measure alone, Sandbu says, it's been a success.
If Europe does well, if the eurozone authorities manage the economy well, that's good, not just for Europe, but it's good for the US, it's good for everyone. And that's why actually you've seen there's been quite a lot of pressure from Washington on eurozone policymakers to get their act together throughout this whole crisis. So this is not just at the moment, it's been for years. They haven't really had their act together. You started out with this great project in 1999. Come 2008, you had the crisis that started here in the US, but within a year or two, it had moved and transmogrified into this big sovereign debt crisis in Europe. And remember that the US has recovered from the crisis. Not, you know, it's not great, but at least it didn't fall back into a second recession. Europe did, or the eurozone did. The countries that use the euro as a currency collectively fell into a second recession in 2011, 2012. A lot of people blame that on the euro itself. They say it was always a crazy idea to put different countries, Germany and Greece, into the same currency, so this had to happen. I disagree. I argue in my new book that this has nothing to do with the structure of the euro. It's just basically policy mess up. They chose bad policies, different from the US policies, and that accounts for a big part of the difference in your economic fortunes.
Well, let's mix in some of the issues that we've been dealing with all year long, and that is, you know, you got the Charlie Hebdo attacks in France at the beginning of the year and the terrible attacks in Paris much later in the year. It appears that it's easier to move money around in the euro project than it is to move people, if you look at the migrant crisis, or than it is to move security information to protect against attacks like we saw in Paris. If that is the case, that's kind of proving not to be true.
I think it would always have been naive to think that that would lead to greater political unity. You know, these things have to go step by step, as German Chancellor Merkel usually says. What has happened is that the mishandling of the eurozone crisis also led to bad politics. There was a poisoning of the politics among the eurozone countries because everyone had been promised there wouldn't have to be bailouts. Everyone had been promised we don't need to take the inferior to Berlin. And the opposite happened out of choice, not out of necessity, is my argument. It becomes harder to deal with something like the refugee crisis, which we've seen throughout this year. And it may, hopefully it will not, make it harder to work together on security issues. So people are seriously talking about putting up border controls again, for example. This was one of the great achievements, the Schengen area, no passport controls between European countries.
I guess it just feels reckless for the European leaders to have mangled these economic policies so much that it's given an opportunity to Marine Le Pen, which everyone knew was a political phenomenon already there, that just need a little watering, and you've got similar movements all across the continent. It seems like a huge and potentially disastrous mistake for the whole world.
So you're quite right. There was a mishandling of the economic crisis that fueled the forces that are nationalist and against European collaboration, the European project. And now we see that that makes it a lot harder to deal precisely with the refugee crisis. I actually think the refugee crisis in itself is something that can be handled. Of course, it's, you know, logistically acute to deal with a million people coming in a year. But the European Union is 500 million. This is 0.2% of the population. It's not something that Europe can't handle. Of course, a little bit of problems in the very short run. But in the long term, Europe needs people. We Europeans should be proud that people want to come to Europe as a sanctuary. We should see the benefit to us in receiving them. Unfortunately, the poisoned politics that have followed from economic mismanagement earlier on makes that very hard to do.
If tomorrow the euro were to go away and we no longer have those blue pieces of paper, what would be the effect on Europe? Could they still be a eurozone with different currencies? Would it mean the whole project is over and they just say, never mind?
I think the consequences would be devastating. if the euro were to be dismantled now, well, first of all, it would happen in a disorderly way. We came close to seeing Greece being expelled in the summer. But the consequences would be much worse than if you hadn't introduced the euro in the first place. So, of course, Europe could work, could function with different currencies. But abolishing the existing common currency would be hugely destabilizing in the short run. You would have financial upheaval, the like of which Europe has probably never seen. But it would be politically devastating too. And that's partly because so much has been invested into this project politically. And its failure makes it very, very hard to see how any renewed push at collaboration and integration could get off the ground in the future. So I think it would make everything worse economically in the short run and politically in the long run. That doesn't mean the euro was a bad idea. I think the euro was a good idea. It wasn't because of flaws in the euro that things have gone badly in the last 5-6 years. It's because people chose very poor policies when the crisis was on them.
Martin Sanbu writes the Financial Times free lunch economics newsletter. He's the author of Europe's Orphan, The Future of the Euro and the Politics of Debt. Mount Everest. Everyone knows what it is, but beyond the fact of its altitude, 29,029 feet, it's hard to talk about.
You, my friends, are following in the very footsteps of history. Something beyond the power of words to describe.
One thing is certain about this very hard, very high place on the planet.
Human beings simply aren't built to function at the cruising altitude of a 747. Our bodies will be literally dying.
2015 gave us the movie Everest about the tragic 1996 disaster in which 15 climbers died. 2015 also gave us a new milestone for climbing deaths, 19 in the aftermath of the Nepalese earthquake that killed thousands of people in Nepal and dwarfed the tragedy on the mountain. For the first time in 30 years, not a single climber made it to the summit. The stunt of climbing Everest subdued by reality. The mountain is called Sagarmatha in Nepal, and in Tibet, it's Chomolungma. It inspires humility, not tourism. Although in a curious irony, tourism from all over the world now supports the local economy. Derek Eland's 2016 will be all about trying to use the power of art and words to describe this place. He's Everest's artist in residence for the year, collecting stories and photos of those who live and work on Everest. They share who they are and why they're there. Eland has always sought to bring art to places of danger.
I was an official British war artist in Afghanistan in 2011, and I wanted to take a unique view of what it's like to be on the front line. So I worked with Afghan, British, American forces to discover what it's like to be human on the front line. And I did that by creating some big brother-style diary rooms in places like shipping containers and hilltop forts. And I asked everyone I met on the front line of any nationality what it's like to be there and to write down their thoughts on a postcard. And that proved to be such an amazing success, such an emotional encounter with these servicemen on the front line that I thought, well, following that, what do I do next? And I decided to go to Everest and to set up a similar Big Brother style diary room or diary tent at Everest Base Camp. It's about 18,000 feet and spend about 6 weeks there collecting stories from the mountain.
And what altitude will you be at?
Base camp's about 17,000, 18,000 feet, so I've got to be careful, like everyone who goes to base camp, about how I get there. I need some help from the Nepalese to get there. I'll set up my diary tent, but then I'm also thinking that perhaps I might need to go slightly higher up the mountain to maybe camp 2, because if I'm collecting stories from people there, Nepalese and Westerners, and I know there's an expedition of American veterans and service men and women going to Everest in April to climb it and to also highlight issues of post-traumatic stress. So there's going to be an incredible gathering of 1,000 or so extraordinary people at Everest Base Camp. And I just want to collect their stories. And if that means going further up the mountain to do so, or to a monastery or to some of the local villages, then I'll do that.
You know, a lot of people who've reported on base camp at Everest have described a complicated visual situation where you've got a beautiful mountain and the society of the Nepalese, but also a sense of people who've kind of used the place and left their oxygen bottles and
litter on, you know, their boot prints on a poor piece of land that was once unspoiled and no longer is.
Yes.
How do you think you'll reconcile that as an artist when you're there?
I'm very conscious of the global warming impact on glaciers and conservation and the rubbish that has been left there. So one of the themes that I do want to explore is, you know, how sustainable is this model of 1,000 people living in this crazy village base camp for 6 weeks and possibly leaving things behind, not just boot prints, but real stuff. And, you know, how's that squared off with the Nepalese view of this as a sacred place? And whilst I don't have an agenda there, you know, other than to try and find out why on earth people are there and what the backstory is. And there's a great quote from Edmund Hillary, which is that it's not the mountain we conquer, but ourselves. And, you know, I want to know what is it about ourselves or them there that they are conquering? What is the backstory? What are they running away from? What are they leaving behind? But of course, there is the impact on the environment there. And, you know, I just don't think it's acceptable to trash Everest in the process.
You'll potentially be in a situation where, unlike Afghanistan, where if someone were to tell a story to you and then go off and be wounded or killed, you might never know where they end up. And if they do end up somewhere, it would probably be buried or back home and that sort of thing. In this situation, you may encounter people who say something to you, tell you a story, and are lost on Everest, and you'll always know that there they are, somewhere above you. Artistically, what do you think that means, and what do you think the value of those possible last words that you will have received from them means to you as an artist?
I think the first thing is that I as an artist, I've got no impact on what happens on the mountain. Indeed, the same was the case in Afghanistan. I had no impact on people being killed and injured. But the fact that I engaged with those people and collected their stories in Afghanistan and also filmed and photographed them meant that there was some residue, there was some legacy from them having been there. So, for example, in Afghanistan, I worked with an Irish regiment, and one of the soldiers who took part in my project wrote his story, was killed. And afterwards, I went to meet his parents to say, well, I want to include your son's story in my exhibition as it tours the world. Do you mind? And when I met them, I showed them his last written words from this intense place. And, you know, they were incredibly grateful that they had something so real and so tangible from Afghanistan. And I guess that also is the case with the Everest project, potentially. I think people will willingly give their stories and tell their stories and write down their emotions because they do want their stories to be heard afterwards. But there is also a sense of, well, let's leave something really tangible and honest behind.
In all the work that you've done, is there a phrase from the diary room postcards that stands out to you, that haunts you particularly, that you think about as you contemplate this Everest mission?
I do, yeah. There was a soldier in Afghanistan who I gave him the postcard, and, you know, he said, "What do I do?" And I said, "Write down what it's like to be here." And he wrote about when he'd been on patrol in Afghanistan. He'd seen a farmer in the field with his son, and they were digging the earth, and it reminded him of he and his dad back in rural west coast of Ireland when they were working the land. And he said the only soldier in that environment, that safe environment on the west coast of Ireland, was our mother, who does battle with cancer, and she's the only real soldier in our family. And I thought that was such an extraordinary connection to make between a farmer in a field with a son and his mother's battle with cancer back home in Ireland. And in fact, I stayed in touch with that soldier, and his mother still survives cancer.
Derek Eland, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Derek Eland will be Everest's artist in residence during the 2016 climbing season. And to learn more about his work, visit derekeland.com.
There's antimony, arsenic, and nickel, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium.
And here's something to take with you today. Scientists have added 4 new elements to the periodic table, the first new addition since 2011 when copernicium was named number 112. 113, 115, 117, and 118 come from teams in Japan, Russia, and the U.S. crashing isotope atoms of 105 dubnium with beams of sodium. The scientists get to name the new elements, and number 113 will be the very first element named in Asia. If you wanted to name an element, the seventh row of the periodic table is now full. You've got to start with 119 and beyond. And by the way, that element dubnium is not named for Freakonomics high priest and the Justin Bieber of podcasts himself, Stephen Dubner. No, no, Dubna is just a town in Russia. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great 2016. This is The Takeaway.
And cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.